Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we welcome Gary Leff of View from the Wing and pretty much everything else in this community. I mean, you are a titan, sir. Welcome.
Welcome, welcome.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm happy to be here and happy to chat with you guys, gentlemen.
Some high praise, Trevor. Call somebody titan right out the bat.
You are. I mean, you've been in this community for so long, and I remember, it's funny, actually, I think it was like 2014 or 2013, and I think I first met you at that Freddie Awards that was at the USA Today, and I still remember to this day, like, you were walking by, and I just happened to say hi, and you actually stopped and took a few minutes to chat. And in my mind, I'm like, you've got this reputation and personality of being, you know, well known and everything, and I'm a nobody, and you're just taking a few minutes to chat.
Well, we were all there for, you know, the same reason, to celebrate frequent flyer programs and hang out with some of the executives and give out some trophies, and we were just all there in fun and got, you know, that's what we were doing. Yeah, that would have been 2013 at USA Today and at that Hilton. And it was this incredibly interesting Hilton too, because, you know, it's in McLean, Virginia. It was, you know, near Hilton's headquarters, and no Hilton hotel had ever had that many guests on property entitled to free breakfast in their entire experience. So there had just been a free gold status offer that was available through Milepoint at the time. And basically, there were 450 or 500 people at that FTU, and everyone staying on property had gold status. And they had like this, there was like a 3-hour wait to get into the restaurant. some properties we've seen, when they're just overwhelmed with elites, they might set up a separate, you know, elite breakfast in a, you know, conference in a ballroom or something. But this hotel didn't quite know what hit them. So that was that was quite the experience. Yeah, that was a dozen years ago.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah, I do remember that long line. I think a lot of people went without that year.
Well, or they like skipped the morning sessions of FTU because they wanted their free breakfast, right? But back then, you got free breakfast. Now, and this was kind of interesting. I remember it was probably, it was less than 2 years later. I remember being in a small group, maybe half a dozen people, talking with Mark Weinstein, who's, you know, CMO at Hilton, way back when he used to run the honors program. And I had actually said, so I kind of feel bad if maybe this idea came from me for these credits. I said, you know, wouldn't it be great if it didn't have to be breakfast? Sometimes you can't take advantage of the breakfast, or, you know, maybe breakfast, you're on a work trip, you know, breakfast is paid for you anyway, or you're going to a breakfast meeting. And Mark said, you know, I actually don't care if anybody like spends the money that we're providing on breakfast or something else. And my idea was, like, hey, you do a credit that you could use at any time, or maybe I wanted to use it for, you know, room service. I didn't want to go down to the restaurant, right? So a credit towards this thing. So you could choose either breakfast, right, or take it as a credit. And what I was thinking in my mind at the time was, when I lived in the dorms in college 100 years ago, and there was a meal plan. And if you went down to the desk by a certain time in the morning, there was a cutoff time. You said, I'm not going to use these meal coupons for the day. You could take a coupon that you could use on campus somewhere for food as a credit. You could eat in the dorm, or, right, have a credit. And that was my, I thought it would be great for Hilton. Well, they just went with the credit. The problem, of course, is that the credit, while convenient, often doesn't cover the cost of breakfast, right? So, you know, it's not the either or, it's the, you know, take this and like it. So that was a little bit unfortunate. And I worry that somehow, you know, that I put this idea into their heads, but just not quite the way I had intended it.
It's kind of funny how that goes. So you've had the chance to interact with a lot of executives in the travel and loyalty space. I know that some time ago, I just lost his name, Jeff Seidel. You guys had I think an opportunity to interact with him when he was leading Gold Passport, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, look, I'm actually still in touch with Jeff. And I talked to him the last few months. Jeff ran the Hyatt program up until not too long after the transition to World of Hyatt.
I still remember that video that he shared, but I'm a diamond.
I'm a diamond guest. It was one of these extra normal videos. And the funny thing is, I literally pulled this up on my screen about 15 minutes ago, and I haven't looked at it in, 2 years. Because I came across a video on social media, somebody had, filmed a guy at the front desk, yelling that he's a diamond at like 4 o'clock in the morning on Twitter. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm a diamond guest. This is one of the best videos. So the setup is, it's this cartoon character who shows up at check-in demanding everything, right? He wants he wants his suite, and it's, oh, I'm guaranteed the best suite. You're guaranteed the best suite if available, right? And he says, I need the suite, and I need a helipad, right, for my giraffe, right? Like, and I need 9 p.m. late checkout. But I'm a diamond guest. And it was sort of poking fun at the entitlement that the programs themselves engender, right? They tell us we are special and that we should be treated with all courtesies. In fact, at Hyatt, their true top status is the courtesy card, which is not something that you can just earn by, stays and nights, but you have to be, nominated for, and is very protected, but does include not just the upgrade to the, to a standard suite, but to the best available suite, right? And so you sort of we sometimes get a little bit entitled in our ways, at least some of us do.
So let's double click into that. And it's a little bit out of the order that we'd sort of laid out the agenda, but I think we can kind of work with it. So we talk about how you mentioned how airlines have sort of, put us into this position of feeling entitled, airlines and loyalty programs in general. But if we look at it now, I mean, Delta's pulling way back on the free upgrades. We're seeing upgrades being sold right out from under elites on the airline side. How do you feel the trend is going, and is this a temporary thing because flights are full? Is this a complete paradigm shift?
Yeah. So to some extent, it's both. But I mean, I think there's a big difference between, being entitled, right, having expectations that are, beyond what's actually been promised to you, right, and expecting the value proposition that's been articulated to be honored. Now, the U.S. market is somewhat unique relative to the most of the world in terms of offering upgrades to available, premium cabin seats that go unsold to their top guests. When I started to fly for work a quarter century ago, 10% of the first class seats were being sold for cash, and the rest were going to, upgrades and awards and employees. Right? It's not that uncommon for, employees to get space available, seats up front domestically. And really, starting a decade ago, that changed. And Delta was at the forefront of that, but all the major carriers do this now. So Delta said, gosh, we're at, in 2015, it was in somewhere in the low 40s% that they were selling. And they wanted to really ratchet this up. And by selling, it doesn't mean just, selling it at like regular price. Although way back when, the reason so few went sold is because they had a full price. And that was really just about it. You paid full price for first class, or you didn't sit in first class other than, with points or upgrades. And, first airlines got a little bit better at, monetization by saying, okay, we have these, more granular fares. It's not always here's the first class fare or here's the first class and the discounted first class. Here, we're going to sell it as an upcharge. So maybe $180, call it, or $250 more than the prevailing coach fare, whatever that is, you can have a first class seat. And that helped them to sell more of them. And that's okay. You're selling it for less, and that's sort of reasonable. And then what they started doing was, and United here was very much at the forefront of the tens of dollars upgrade, right? This idea of we're not just selling you a discounted fare, but post-purchase, we're going to offer you, okay, you didn't buy first before, but would you take it for, $49.95, okay? Or, usually $49 or $59 or, $79. I remember as a non-elite Mileage Plus being offered a $59 upgrade from United several years ago, where the offer was expressly framed as, here are the number of elites on the upgrade list looking for a complimentary upgrade, right? Would you like to jump in front of all of them for $59, right? That felt like, a little weird. It's, now they're saying, okay, you're more important if you'll spend, you're not a regular customer of ours. Maybe you fly United once a year, maybe not even that. $59 from you, more than offering the seat to somebody who's spending, $30,000, $50,000 a year. But that's the direction that kind of all of them have gone, and increasingly even for international flights. I've seen Delta offer first-class upgrades on short flights for as low as $26. I've never seen American go below $40. But the idea being that they keep offering, and the fewer seats are filling up, they will offer it, cheap to everyone. So it basically, like, if nobody wants the $40 upgrade, then it's available as a complimentary upgrade. Now, at the same time, when they're offering it at $40 or $26, anybody with a modicum of status, it's like, it's because you're probably going to get the complimentary upgrade, mm-hmm. right? So if they were, if they were filling in the cabin, they wouldn't be selling it so cheap. So, like, do you buy that? Do you not? Still, it does, make it so it's much less common that complimentary upgrades are available. Delta has said that they are now making, it's 12 to 13% of their first class seats available for upgrade, right? So it's a complete reversal. Mm-hmm. And that means, there are some planes and some routes where, first class upgrades are available all the time, right? Because there aren't a lot of premium passengers and they're short and people aren't buying them. But by the flip side is then there are routes where it's almost never going to be a first class upgrade for any, it can be a Delta 360, it doesn't matter, where you, where you are in the diamond queue, like an upgrade just isn't going to happen. So, the idea of what the value proposition was behind the status has changed a lot, and the marketing really hasn't changed around it. So airlines still promote the upgrade as though this is the thing that you're going to get for your loyalty, but they aren't really delivering the upgrade in the same way. Now, Delta's approach, of course, this starting 10 years ago, was to say that Comfort Plus, i.e. extra legroom seats, are an upgrade, and they even run an upgrade algorithm to put people into it. And so, you're in a exit row aisle, and now you're being upgraded into a Comfort Plus middle seat. And then that was the problem. Okay, I've got to let people opt out of that, right? Because that's like not better. There's like a more robust snack basket if that's your bag. But they wanted to normalize the idea of extra legroom coach being an upgrade because they wanted it to replace the idea of first class as an expectation, much like, much of the rest of the world. Now, at the same time, frequent flyer programs in the U.S. are also, far more profitable than the rest of the world. It's very much very important to drive, this sort of loyalty and, keep people on a treadmill earning the status, because it's not just selling seats, it's selling credit cards. And those are, in Delta's, $7 billion from American Express at, call it a 37% margin, which was their number, back in 2021 when they were raising debt against the SkyMiles program. American was 52% margin. Right, for their $5.5 or $6 billion deal with Citibank, the keeping people on that hamster wheel is really important. So they're marketing as though you're going to get the upgrade. Not the airlines aren't delivering the upgrade in the same way, and so the game really has changed. And I do consider, do I want to buy an upgrade? Look, I know that hub to hub on American, DCA to DFW, the odds that I'm just about ever getting that upgrade are pretty low.
I was going to say, do you feel like the hamster wheel is broken? Because, again, with that flipping where you're used to give away, 90% of your premium seats as upgrades, and now you're only giving away 10 or 11%. And you're right, like the really long transcons and some of the hub to hub or the high elite member routes are just never going to be available for upgrade. So to me, I feel like the hamster wheel, for the most part, I mean, I know for me, I've always chased elite status, and this is probably the first year I haven't been attracted to the programs to really, you know, chase after it. I know personally, the hamster wheel is kind of broken for me because I'm just not seeing the value. What do you see the airlines doing to evolve this? Because, I mean, you know, this is their cash cow, right? The loyalty programs yeah. is where they've been kind of delivering a lot of their profit and their margin. But, you know, it seems like in some cases, like maybe they're going to need to evolve, or they're going to change that marketing in some way so that they can really entice people to keep going on that hamster wheel, continue to chase the elite status. Because, yeah. you know, the old strategy of, oh, it's because you're going to get a free upgrade. That's not really the deal that's being offered anymore, is it?
You know, I do think it's broken in a meaningful way. There are some things that airlines are doing about that, but the value proposition is very different. So I think that for most people, mid-tier status is a much better sweet spot than top tier mm-hmm. in the sense of, you know, confirm the extra legroom seats at booking, right? So you're going to get that better experience. You're still higher on wait lists when you need to be reaccommodated during irregular operations. You're getting your free check bag and your priority boarding. And, you know, so you're not going to have to, you know, gate check your bag probably. So it is that still better experience. And with full planes, the better experience can matter. You know, there was a time when a third of seats were empty. And so anybody could get reaccommodated if they were, you know, if at any time, just about. So that's not the case anymore. So I think status can matter to the overall travel experience. I think that there's a lot of the benefits are achieved at the mid-tier. Disclosure, I'm still earning, you know, executive platinum with American, but frankly, it's like easier than it used to. There was a time when I needed to fly somewhere, I would go to AA.com, right? It was like, they treat me so well, I'm not going to go anywhere else. I'm just buying my ticket from American. It was, you know, 2012, 2013. It was a different world. Now, like, I don't, you know, I'll fly kind of whoever's got the better schedule. I do my best to avoid, honestly, right now, Southwest, because their internet's too spotty and I want to work and be productive on the flight. United's kind of been the same, but it's gotten better. And with Starlink, once that's rolled out, that's going to be awesome. But I fly everyone, but I'm still earning that, you know, that executive platinum, but I'm doing it pretty easily, naturally, plus kind of all the activities and advantage that are available. And there can often be the, you know, more lucrative option anyway, and it creates status. So what are airlines doing? Well, for confirmed upgrades, we often see those no longer just by, you know, conferring at the status level, but instead becoming choice benefits. Or with the way United flipped it is to say you're earning these plus points, but there are other things you can do with them besides upgrade now. And so people who are frustrated by the upgrade process have alternatives. And it can be, you know, whether it's club membership or access to, you know, or business class lounge access when you're not otherwise eligible. American even has, you know, flagship, you know, first dining passes, or at least they have had, you know, have had these. And so things you can opt instead of the confirmed upgrade. It doesn't change the complimentary unlimited upgrade algorithm that was, you know, the sine qua non of status, really since, you know, Continental One Pass in their, you know, challenges over 30 years ago. That was kind of the beginning of this. But I feel like but that does, and so the airlines haven't figured out how to give enough value that's going to keep folks on that treadmill. I've seen my Advantage loyalty point number fall this year relative to last. You know, 500. Like, if they made concierge key an actual like level, they say, okay, a million loyalty points, right? I am going to be like in their shopping portal, you know, every day, okay? Because I was briefly a CK, and that was actually all. Like, I didn't, my upgrade percentage wasn't always great. I remember getting onto a flight in Charlotte where I was one of four CKs and back. It happened. Wow. But it was still, I mean, just being guaranteed the next flight, not even if it was oversold during irregular operations, this is amazing. And so, yeah, I would absolutely shoot for that if there was a guaranteed criteria. But gosh, I would hate to, you know, put all those eggs in the Advantage basket to go for like a million loyalty points and then not get it. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. That would leave a bad taste.
You sort of hinted at it, but like the milestones that they're that loyalty programs in general have been putting out there, right? I just noticed in my Hyatt account that I've got to address like probably 5 different milestones because I never do until I get to the end of the year.
Oh, bad. Do it before they expire.
Yeah.
So this is important. This is important, right? With Hyatt, you have 90 days from when you earn them. And you, if 90 days is going to put you into the next calendar year, you want to save them. So, you know, I dump the email that they send me that I've gotten this into a calendar reminder in my Outlook. And I, you know, and so that it shows up, you know, at the beginning of the calendar year, because like if you're claiming a suite upgrade, during 2025, it's going to expire in a year. If you do it in January 26, you're going to have 2 years. So I wait.
Exactly. And that was my strategy as well, as I ended up getting a bunch of the nights in the last probably 30, 45 days. So January 1st, I know exactly what I'm doing. But it feels to me like they've really kind of done this gamification, right? Every so often, if you're close to that next milestone, they'll send you an email. Hey, you're only 5,000 more loyalty points, or 5,000, you know, 5 more nights. Do you think that's helping or hurting the programs and sort of how we are loyal to them? Because I feel like, to me, it's a little bit of a slap in the face. Like, hey, I've been a globalist since the program became World of Hyatt, and you're sort of trying to goad me on. Like, do you not know how long I've been a globalist here?
Yeah, this is the thing, is that, you know, despite all the data that they have, there's not really true personalization, right? And this is weird, given how far we've come with AI. They ought to be able to take all the data and everything they know and do, you know, personalized sorts of communications that says, you know, this customer, you know, we're pretty confident, you know, they know the score. And if they want to prompt you with it, at least acknowledge, you know, look, we know you've got this, like, cause you have for so long. But we, you know, we want to make sure we know you're busy, and put this on your radar too, just in case it wasn't, would be, you know, one way of framing that. Whereas the median member actually may not be that familiar, with the particulars. Things get confusing. Oh, I'm at 69. No, I'm a globalist, right? But I haven't hit the 69th threshold, so I don't get the 69th benefits. And, you know, oh, the concierge is a 69th benefit. Doesn't come with globalist. Like, how does that all work? These things actually do get confusing. And frankly, a lot of the loyalty program executives themselves don't keep their own programs straight. It's like, okay, wait, how does this like work? You know, and often like we know much better than they do the details of their own program, because all these, you know, rules have been built on rules and have been built on rules over, you know, decades, and someone changes something and, you know, and then how does it play out in reality? And they're not the ones often experiencing the on the ground, this sort of eat your own dog food kind of moments for the marketer, that, you know, that's the reality of how the stuff experienced. So
that, you know, yeah, that does kind of sound kind of exciting for the future, where, you know, how does somebody recognize you to make you feel special, right? And there's so many ways to do that, and that is there's a bit of personalization there, because, you know, not all customers are the same. They value things differently within each of the programs, and there probably is that opportunity for these loyalty programs to go out and start figuring out, how do we segment the, you know, our population of people and say, these people really care about this. These people really care about this. And, you know, how do we reflect that in the program? So I guess that is something that I hadn't thought of until you mentioned it, that probably is an opportunity, especially with, you know, the various, you know, data mining and AI and other tools to try to really, you know, get into the mind of the customer and figure out, how do we make the loyalty personalized to them and provide them the offers and the, you know, benefits that specifically drive their behavior, right?
I mean, the first way is choice, but it gets really confusing. So, you know, Alaska came out with their, you know, you can choose to earn based on segments. You can earn based on, you know, distance. Right. You can earn based on revenue. I think that's, I love that. That's great. But, right, you know, for the, but for the median member, this, you know, this is like a lot of math,
It's like a lot of algebra.
And so then there's an opportunity on the other side for the frequent flyer AI agent to kind of manage this complex monstrosity mm-hmm. for you and to actually tell you what you should be doing. But it would be great if the program kind of fed that to you. But there's also recognition in another way. One thing that United does really well is in-person recognition at million-mile thresholds. Right. You know, you're cross, you know, you're on the plane, you know, it'll be, you know, maybe they'll meet you at the gate before, you'll be gifted something in the cabin, then you get a note from the pilot and you maybe offer mm-hmm. the opportunity mm-hmm. to come sit in the cockpit. Obviously some pilots will do it and some won't. And, you know, the execution can change on the ground, but United does a really good job with these thresholds. And it's this moment that means so much to the customer, but to the kind of nameless, faceless corporation, it's just a database entry, and they've changed it from the database entry to a, you know, to elevate it to meet the human moment that really recognizes the milestone and says, you know, thank you and honors the customer in a way that drives, you know, ultimately what you want to do is, you know, some people would call it, you know, driving kind of an irrational loyalty. I tend to think of it more as, you know, subjective preferences, and we get really invested in this stuff and, you know, delivering the value that people, you know, that means the most to that customer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what programs can get in a lot of trouble doing is just trying to out invest, you know, compared to competitors. Like, so I gave a talk 7 years ago at an event for like all the, like the executives, all the programs that issue, you know, a particular kind of credit card, you know, through one of the payment networks. And what I told them, I said, look, at this point you have kind of two options if you want to be competitive in rewards. One, you know, and this was, you know, a year and a half after Sapphire Reserve was first released, and they hadn't even cut back, and they were still doing like unlimited guests with your, you know, with your Priority Pass. And when it first released, you got your $300, the $300 travel credit was per calendar year, not per, you know, per card member year. And so like first year, like you did twice and all, and you earn points still on the $300 that you spent that got credited back. And as a different look, there's two ways you can go. You can either outspend Chase. Okay. And by the way, you know, the filings that they've made so far says that like even they're not making money on this. Or, you know, you can really target your spending in ways that meet the customer where they are and deliver the thing that they value most that only you can provide. And the two, and I gave three examples of that at the time. So first of all, Frontier was actually the first one. They had just come out with $1 spent on the card was one elite qualifying mile. They were the first to do it, right? So when American came out with their loyalty points, I remember that they appreciated that the coverage in the Wall Street Journal noted that they were actually first before American, because like Americans come up with this new way. Well, it's not exactly new, here's a card where spend really rides on the rails of the program. Hyatt had come out with their, you know, we mentioned every 10 nights you get additional benefits. So it's like every increment, you keep getting pushed for a little more because you're always so mm-hmm. close. And then the card comes in and is giving you, you know, two nights per 5,000 spend. And so pushes you over, you know, there's always a reason to spend a little bit more. Or I said, look, you know, what really drives emotional connections? When you have this, the opportunities that couldn't be opened up any other way, I think I look at these different experience kinds of marketplaces. The problem is, number one, they don't scale. And number two is we never, like nobody ever knows what the opportunities are. Because like who goes to those websites? And so it just so happens that in the city I'm traveling to, they have this experience that is that like I really want to do, that's at a reasonable price point, like that's the perfect match. And so there's this, the opportunity exists, the customers would want them, and they're never even like, and but at the time, as it is 2018, surely as we're getting like better AI, we should be able to take the data that you know about a customer, right? And match the opportunities that you have and push that, you know, opportunity to them and say, okay, you've just spent this dollars on this ticket. You're going to be in this city. We know that you know, frequent these restaurants. Here's this chef whose restaurants you go to like a lot, who's doing a thing. When you're going to be there on your dates, you know, do you have time? We'd love to set this up for you. Mind blow. Okay. And then it's like, doesn't matter. If you're only getting, you know, a third the value, like maybe you don't value the priority pass from Chase because you've got like 13 other priority pass cards, right? And like, you know, and or half the other things that are being layered in. You don't need all of the statement credits that Amex, the ones they're even paying for, not just the ones that they're selling you to a brand as a customer. Maybe you don't need half of those that spend. Once that's delivered, like they've got you, mm-hmm. right? Deliver the things that really matter in a tailored, targeted way. Get asymmetric, value, right?
Yeah, and that's interesting. I say this as last night I just spent money on First Dibs, which I had never heard of until the Strata Elite, and also booked a Black Lane. I mean, it's almost like I've got to get smart on so many different things because of the coupon book approach rather than actually generating real value and making me want to keep the card in my wallet like I do for the Capital One Venture, like I do for the Bilt card, and like I used to do for the Mesa card for my first $1,000 of spend per month until it failed while I was at Costco on the day that just a few hours before they sent an email out saying we're closing all accounts.
and I've been like, look, I don't want to keep balances in Mesa because they haven't raised very much money, and they're even struggling to onboard new card members. There are all these people getting wait lists when they want to be card members. Like, this is just not a sustainable thing. So I don't want to leave all these points in my account. I was about to cash them out, and they came out with this Omni partnership. And I said, okay, well, we got Omni, and Omni has this really interesting chart where it's a fixed point redemption for a free night. And it's the same price whether you're staying at like the cheap Florida hotel in the off season or peak time in New York, as long as it's not a blackout date. And I've seen like these $1,000 a night rooms in New York that you could redeem 30,000 points for. Oh, maybe I want to do that. And they're going to throw in status. And I'm like, hemming and hawing. And this came like a couple weeks before the thing folded. And so I was going to just transfer them all out to Aeroplan like 2 weeks earlier. And I'm like, And so, yeah, I got caught up in that too. my own indecision caught me with more points than I would have wanted there. But the coupon book thing, first of all, is interesting. Obviously, there's a few things going on there, but they're not. I'm glad you figured out First Dibs. I mean, I use my Strata credit just with American Airlines. But the American's new mid-tier Globe card has the First Dibs as an option and not just an American credit, and I've got to figure out what to do with that. I don't have a tremendous amount of time to do it here, right? And it's just not my stuff. But maybe you know something that's got a good market value to someone else.
Well, in my case, I was able to. I did the go to the site as you do with the Capital One. Plug-in on, and then I left, and I got an 18% cashback offer, and then I went back and ended up buying earrings for my wife, which she hasn't had in a while, and so they've got some nice jewelry there, but yeah, most of it's really really overpriced. I shouldn't say overpriced. Most of it's very very expensive. I don't know whether it's value for it. We'll see what the earrings look like, but I mean, for me, I got it to be like less than $50 out of pocket. Between the Capital One and everything. And so for me, that's enough.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, when I went there, I didn't look like their archetypal customer for them.
Well, and it's interesting that you say that, because I think after all the years of American Express being that coupon book, they've finally tweaked the Platinum, the personal Platinum, at least to me as a customer, between Lululemon, which I think a lot of us travelers, have found that they can be comfortable. The ABC pants, for example, are my favorite travel attire. And, the Resi credit, I mean, for me, the Platinum is actually starting to be more valuable. I'm probably not going to keep them all, as we never do, because that annual fee is so high. But I feel like they're at least dialing it in more to the lifestyle of at least people in our community.
Well, the thing about the Amex Platinum is, look, I am going to keep my card, my personal Platinum. I think I'm not as keen on. I used to think that the business card was a much better play than the consumer card. I'm not convinced of that anymore. But and I'm going to get way more value than the annual fee. It keeps it in my, in my possession. I continue to have, Centurion Lounge access for if I want that. At basically, I'm not paying extra for it because of the amount of value I'm getting back. But it's not a card that I want to put spending on other than potentially airfare. This is the thing. It's a, and maybe they find that once they get it in your wallet and, the median customer just does keep using it. And it's a mirror card. You want to pull out your mirror card, right? And I do think they did a really nice job on the finish on the mirror version of that, to be fair. But I'm just not going to put, except where I'm getting statement credits, except where I'm getting, 5X. It's just not going to be a place I'm going to put actual spending. And this is why I have the very unpopular view that, for all of the frustrations with it, in some ways, Sapphire Reserve was a better refresh in that at least there's a reason to put, I'll put, hotel direct, hotel spending on it and earn 4X. I can earn 4X on direct air if I'm not going to use Amex Platinum or I don't have Amex Platinum. I could even get 8X on airfare through their portal. And, I do a lot of airfare spend for myself, for others, hotel spend, that I can get to 75K and I get these threshold bonuses, which I live in a Southwest Airlines market, right? Where 41% of the seats out of Austin are Southwest Airlines. So a Southwest Airlines credit is useful to me. Southwest Airlines status, even when I avoid them, it's like useful to me. I'm finding the shops with Chase really frustrating because the limited inventory of stuff they have is all full price and I can often get discounted for the same thing somewhere else. So what does a $250 credit really get? Like they had through December 31, they have a $250 off 500 at Toomey and I could use my $250 credit for Toomey goods through the shops at Chase. And I'm thinking, wow, how awesome. As long as I buy a $500, Toomey item, I should be able to, get a great deal. And then I go and I look and I see, it's a limited inventory of the stuff they have. The stuff that I actually want isn't there. Toomey's kind of expensive for what it is anyway, in my view. And, at the time when I was looking, Toomey was running sales for a couple hundred bucks off. Right. So which I lose if I go.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, and so the implementation here matters a lot.
Yeah, that's the thing for some of these credit cards, the value proposition is just tough. It's funny that you mentioned putting your travel on or your airlines on Amex. I feel like that's where Chase really, really did it well with the Sapphire Reserve. Is they make the travel interruption insurance or whatever that protection is called so easy. I've had that probably two or three different claims that I've had to make, and every time it is just the simplest process. But I want to sort of tweak us a little bit toward the future when we look at credit cards and we look at co-brands and that sort of thing. You mentioned earlier in the conversation that Delta had a particular number that they wanted to get to with Amex based on I suppose the amount of debt that they were taking on. If I understood that correctly, maybe I misunderstood that, but I mean essentially they were. I think you mentioned that they. They were valuing the SkyMiles program at a particular level, primarily because of all the co-brand partnership that they have with Amex. These agreements are probably coming up due probably in the next 5 years, I'd imagine, for some of them. What do you see the future look like?
With Delta, so there were two things with Delta. So the what I mentioned with Delta was the same was something that was true with United and American also, that during the pandemic they took out tremendous debt backed by the revenue streams of their loyalty programs. With almost any company in the world, marketing is an expense line. With the airlines, it's the major driver of profit, which is crazy in a way. But as part of issuing all of this debt, there was greater financial disclosure about the loyalty programs than had traditionally been the case. And so we learned things like their internal estimates of the margins of the programs. And so, you saw a thing, American claimed about a 52% margin. Delta at the time was either 37 or 39. I have to look. I want to say 39. And United was in between them. this is an artifact of just what their internal pricing for things looks like that drives some of that margin. It's not the case that then, you know, Delta is just a less profitable program than Advantage. There's internal pricing issues in accounting, but you know, hugely valuable. But the point about the where they are with their credit card deals. So in 2019, Delta had done a 10-year extension with American Express. So Delta's runs until 2029. And at that time, they said that in 2023, they expected to hit $7 billion in revenue as part of that deal. They just slightly missed that. So it was around $6.9 billion. But that $6.9 billion came after 20% pandemic inflation that everyone forgets. So this was not something baked into the projection. So what you really want to do is back 20% off of that, and you're looking at, you know, they apples to apples, did more like $5.6 billion in 2023 from in 2019 dollars, right? Not the seven that they were anticipating doing. So what I suggest there is, although this is, you know, the most successful co-brand, it's also the most comprehensive, you know, across their business. From Delta actually has the single highest credit line on any American Express card. It's over $1 billion, and they use it for jet fuel. Right. So Amex is getting interchange on, you know, on a big chunk of Delta jet fuel purchases. So it's, you know, across the business, all these ways that they've come up with to, you know, throw more into the deal and ratchet up that number. So incredibly successful co-brand, but at the same time, not clear that it's doing as much as they'd hoped. And so we do see, you know, desperately looking to find more customers to feed the top of the funnel. And so what are they doing when they give free Wi-Fi, but you got to be a SkyMiles member? Right? They want you joining the program so they can market to you and get you to take the co-brand. They say like 1 in 8 SkyMiles members has the card. It's not likely that the marginal member is going to convert at that same rate, but they need more members to feed this. Similarly, what are they really getting? And they're not just selling miles to Uber and to Starbucks, right? They're getting access to Uber and Starbucks customers that may not necessarily be Delta customers. And why is that good? Because these are people that you can try to convert and sell more cards. Hard to, because they need to find ways, just about everyone in their database already that was possibly going to take a Delta SkyMiles American Express card surely has had at least one, right? And so, you know, they may be topping out, and especially when they yanked so much value out of the program, because I can see the case for spending incrementally towards status, although we've talked about, you know, how much is that status necessarily worth. But outside of the status case, which is a subset of the members and a subset, it's certainly not 1 in 8 that have the card, right? I was blown away when I'm sitting in Skift beginning of December, their aviation forum, you know, and Dave Neelman's up there, and he admits that his primary card is a Delta American Express card. He's the CEO of Breeze. Breeze has their own co-brand card. Put your spending on the Breeze card, right? But okay, he wants, now the guy has doesn't need his points to be able to fly his grandkids to Utah. Okay. Man's done fine. He's a co-founder of JetBlue, and he owns a portion of Tap Air Portugal and Azul. Very, very successful. Before JetBlue, I mean, there was, you know, Morris Air that Southwest acquired. Very successful. He could like pay, but he's using, you know, he's like, well, I use my Delta, you know, miles to fly my family to come visit me. He could get a, you know, no annual fee Citi Double Cash card, and his points would go like twice as far in getting his grandkids to come visit him, even flying Delta, and then they'd earn miles too, like on the flights. Like, why people do this? And, you know, there is this sense in which there's hub captives, and you think, well, I fly the airline, and so I, you know, I should get their card, and it helps me with, you know, boarding and bags, and well, now this is my card, and so I use it. But there's only so much of that, and, you know, so many other. And what the banks have certainly taught us is that they don't need the airlines to get customers, right? Sapphire Reserve, you know, maybe it wasn't a super profitable product, but it was a, you know, very popular product, getting, you know, affluent consumers to to take it and spend. You know, Amex Platinum is still a flagship product without the, you know, co-brand relationship, just the transfer relationships. You know, so they can do that. And I think we've seen the bank proprietary products become more lucrative for the consumer, right? The money isn't all being siphoned off into the airline partnership, being paid for access to the database and, you know, brand licensing. And so actually investing it in the consumer. So, you know, I think that's a problem for the airlines.
You know, I'd like to spend a second about that because, you know, I was reading an article recently or one of the blog posts from One Mile at a Time about, you know, how the airlines are starting to kind of, I think, erode that a little bit because, you know, you see more and more of the loyalty programs going in and restricting some of the premium award space, right, for their own elite members and their own members of their actual programs and not for partners and for these like transferable currency type of situations, right? So, you know, like, if you want to fly Le Premier, you have to be a flying Blue Elite. If you want to, you know, redeem for Emirates First Class, you know, they're going to make it harder if you're not an elite member in their Emirates Flyer program. And you know, United having special space for some of their elite members. Do you see that as a trend that is going to kind of maybe erode some of that, the preeminence of those transferable currencies from the banks? Because suddenly the value proposition of being able to transfer and, you know, oh, I'm going to redeem Aeroplan miles or Life miles or, you know, I'm going to redeem, you know, something in this program. As the carriers kind of maybe go in that direction where they're starting to insulate and be less you know, good partners from an award availability perspective for other partners in their various alliances, you know, does that kind of erode some of the value of some of these transferable currencies?
Yeah, so it does. You know, we had seen this for a long time with better availability using a program's own miles with Miles and More, right? Mm-hmm. You could get Lufthansa first class awards more than, you know, 3 or 14 days in advance if you were using Miles and More miles. And you didn't even need to have status. Swiss first became restricted to members with status. It's really since the pandemic that we've seen a massive escalation of this. Now we see you know, Qantas offering their own members more availability than partner airlines. Now, that doesn't require elite status. So if you're a credit card transfer partner in Qantas, you have the access to the Qantas space. The same is true with, you know, Cathay Pacific and Asia Miles, where, you know, they didn't really used to segregate availability between partner and, you know, the you know, how they ticketed. You know, the or who ticketed didn't, you know, change the access to the availability, and now it does. But, you know, any transfer partner into Cathay, you know, has that extra availability, and we're seeing that with, you know, with a lot of airlines now. Obviously, with United limiting to card members and elites for the lower price or partner saver kind of bucket inventory. And their desire is to push people into the co-brand, which actually doesn't force you to spend on the co-brand at all, which is kind of weird. They just like to have it. If you have a lot of United miles, it can be a reason to get that card. Delta, with their 15% discount for, you know, discount for their own co-brand card members versus, you know, versus others, which, you know, but we've seen, you know, similar things elsewhere. La Premier requires not just that, it used to require just status, right? And now it requires platinum status or, you know, their true top. So in some cases, the transferable points are helpful, right? Transfer to Cathay, transfer to Qantas, have access to better availability than if you were earning, you know, American miles with an American credit card. You know, American no longer has access to, you know, Etihad's premium space booked far in advance, but you can transfer to Etihad and have that access. You know, they no longer have access to the same inventory that Avios programs offer to to other Avios programs, but you can transfer into Avios and get it. Right. So in some sense, the transferable points currencies get more valuable, but there is a greater dispersion that certainly happens as airlines treat partners differently, treat elites differently. And that's not, I don't like that trend, but I understand it. You know, in 2021, Scott Kirby had promised that they would double mileage plus revenue in 4 years, and they didn't. right? And so he just came out again a few months ago with the same claim, and nobody seems to remember that he like made this claim in 2021. But like, how is this going to happen? Well, they need to push the co-brand. It's going to happen because at the end of the five-year period is when they're, you know, renegotiating that Chase deal again, and they expect Chase to pay more. And then they have, you know, everyone's starting to get the mileage earning debit cards because they figured out, you know, finally a way to simultaneously circumvent the Durbin Amendment to Dodd-Frank using small banks as issuers, but that you can spread, you can have an application done nationally, right? Not like small, you know, paper processes with a small bank. And you can even spread deposits across banks if you need to. So, because the program could easily be too big if you're a United or you're Southwest. And so you can automate the stuff, you know, spread the banks and, you know, do all of the infrastructural things that maybe wasn't possible 10 years ago, and to bring back your rewards debit. Maybe there's a lot of, you know, everyone's going to be doing it right now. We've seen Southwest and, you know, Wyndham as, you know, as well as United. But, you know that as soon as that came out, the heads of all the programs were like asking the people working for them, where are we on this? Right. Because it's a whole, I mean, the other thing that they had to do, right, was to make the partner banks comfortable with it, that it wasn't a competitor product to the credit card, that they could actually offer, you know, all these folks have deals, exclusive deals to issue their credit card, but they're not totally exclusive. They generally allow you to, they generally have like a second look provision. You could bring on a bank that could issue cards to the customers that say Chase doesn't take from United, right? But United hasn't gone and gotten a second look issuer. And so it's a kind of a, like, people are uncomfortable with that business. But the bet here is, instead of being a competitor to a Chase card, that this is a gateway into it. That, you know, maybe you reach these customers who aren't taking credit cards or aren't developed enough for the credit card, and you graduate them in the Mileage Plus ecosystem to a Chase credit card. And so getting those big partners comfortable with it, getting the technology, and you bring back, you know, rewards debit. And so I suspect we'll see a lot more of that. It's part of how they're, I think, about how can they get this revenue growth at a time that maybe the main driver of revenue in these co-brands is stagnated, especially as the deals have gotten so expensive, which makes it hard to actually be that rewarding for the customer. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling, you know, kind of self-destructive thing. It's so lucrative that there's just no money left for the customer. You know, it's so bad nobody wants them anymore.
Do you think that American going with the ability to get the loyalty points from credit card spend has helped them and their program's profitability?
It certainly hasn't hurt. You know, look, we know we're talking about margins. You know, selling tickets is not a high margin business, right? At American, their cost per available seat mile is greater than passenger revenue per available seat mile. So like, you lose money moving planes around, and you make money as a company by, selling miles to Citibank. So, you know, if you structure your program, I mean, this was what you want to incentivize high margin business, which is why it was always so crazy initially as these programs start to go revenue based. It's, okay, we'll give you points on the ticket, but not on, paid seat assignments. Right? Like, not on checked bags. Well, what's higher margin once you've already got the passenger than paying more for the seat assignment? But why do they do it? Because it's hard. Because they were looking at a ticket number to associate with generate the miles. And if there's no ticket number for the ancillary transaction, then they needed a separate process to deliver the miles. But what you wanted to, like, forget rewarding the ticket. That's like, you're losing money. You want less of the losing money. You want, you know, if you could sell seats without a ticket, like, that'd be great. Like, you reward that. Like, that's not how it works. But the point, of course, is that rewarding the high value, high margin, you know, profitable activity is good. You're going to get more of that. And, you know, American, look, if I were American when they did that, it would be absolutely the thing to do, because American has needed to lean into the Advantage program. Like, if you're Delta, they've even said, you know, that, you know, it's, they have this brand and this reliability, and that they're not trying to compete on, you know, value for their points. And, but if you're American, You haven't had that brand. You haven't had the same historical reliability. You don't have the international route network of a United Airlines, right? So what do you lean into? You lean into, well, we have our domestic southern strategy. We fly to everywhere in Mexico where there's a paved airport, a paved runway, and we have a marginally better frequent flyer program. And this makes sense. And I think that they and we've seen Delta and United move more towards American in having more things count towards status and having more spend count more towards status. So, there's a reason that we're seeing that.
I feel like we could talk industry stuff for probably another hour. But I was
easily.
but I wonder if we could pivot a little bit. Gary, we've traveled similarly. I think all three of us traveled very similarly, before, obviously before you and I, before kids. We like our premium cabins. We had no problem doing a real quick trip. I think you went to, was it Madrid or Paris for dinner one time? I know that I've done crazy things like a 90-minute turn in Cairo, Egypt on a mileage run, or my wife and I used to call our flights back and forth to Colombo, Sri Lanka over a weekend, kind of like dinner and a movie or two movies and probably multiple
dinners.
Some
of us still go to Europe for a meal,
Exactly. So, I say all that to say, to ask, how has your travel changed and how has your, how you play the game, so to speak, changed, now that you're traveling with a family?
Yeah. So it changes a lot. I did travel to Barcelona for dinner with my wife, and gosh, I remember we flew British Airways over on using Asia Miles that we had got by converting eBay Anything points, because back in the day you could make 35 four-star Priceline hotel bookings, get enough eBay points for business class to Europe through Cathay Pacific. It was a great thing. But, the first thing is that travel with kids and, bigger family means you're looking for more seats. It takes more miles. Your options are more limited because getting, one seat is easier than two. Two is easier than three. Three is easier than four, right? And so you want, you need more seats. Then you've got the constraints of school schedules, right? And so then you're competing for seats whenever. The great thing about, when you have flexibility to travel when you want is you can go when other people aren't. And the best award availability and the best pricing is going to be when there are extra, like, empty seats on planes versus traveling when everyone else is traveling during, Christmas break, spring break, and the summer vacations. These summers are a longer period, and you get, like, maybe not everyone trying to go to the same places because it's like maybe not cold. We're in the northern hemisphere, but you're going when everyone else is going. You need more seats, right? And then the kids aren't always as up for the same kind of travel and the same. So a couple of concrete examples. My son is 1.5. Okay. When he hits 2, he probably isn't going to be ready for his own first class suite where he doesn't see us when he's belted in. I got to give my daughter credit. At 3.5, she was great in a business suite. It's almost easier when you can use those old style business class, just the old diamond seat. And there's no privacy. You're basically just sitting next to each other. It lies flat, but it's kind of open. With little kids, that can be really better. My daughter, when she was 4, I mean, she was the first time she did a back-to-back long haul. She's great. We did Austin, London, Abu Dhabi. I mean, so 8 hours, but it was, back-to-backs. And she did her own first apartment on Etihad. So she was fine in her own space, not for takeoff and landing. But it was plenty of space. We can share it after that. But, so we've still done that, but it's a lot harder and you need a lot more points. And so I'm also much more inclined to, visit things that they want to see, right? It's as much driven by activities with them. Although, look, there's a lot of great kids clubs, which is wonderful at resorts. But, interest in my own interest in, Disney was a little bit limited, although you know, many years ago, 20 years ago, I took my wife. She'd never been to, you know, Disney. So I took her to Tokyo Disney, right? Which, of course, has Disney Sea. Like, also, it's like, you know, and maybe I didn't want to sit through It's a Small World, but when they're singing it in Japanese, like, it's pretty cool. But, you know, so the things that they want to do are different. Even just Hawaii. I wouldn't historically spend a ton of time on, say, in Waikiki. But there's so much to do with kids there, right? I can take, you know, take them to the zoo, you know, stuff that I'm not going to do on, say, you know, Kauai in the same way. So my preference is very much sublimate to, you know, I mean, this past summer, my daughter had, we let her pick one of the trips, right? And so she had two ideas. She either wanted to go to Venice because she wanted to see how people got around on boats instead of cars, or she wanted to see the pyramids in Egypt. And I thought, well, first of all, like Cairo in July, like didn't super like appeal to me.
Little warm.
although, you know, the idea of like Venice over the summer, like is not like, but I said, okay, if we show up midweek, right, after the non-staying tourist tax ends, so technically after peak of peak, and it's midweek, and we stay, you know, outside of the center of the really touristy activities in Venice, you know, I can manage this. Okay, but she, you know, but we defer, you know, we try to make it as much about, you know, like their preferences as ours.
Yeah, and I feel like we travel slower. I do. We used to do, you know, the quick two, maybe three nights in Europe or less. And now it's always trying to get to that four. We've got a trip to Australia and it's going to be 3.5 weeks, which is probably the longest trip I've ever taken. Oh, yeah. but to the point, it's more miles. So you want to get more value out of those miles. And I feel like one thing that we look for, and my daughter's only four right now, the thing she's more interested in, I think, are the playgrounds and the parks. Yeah. And having been spending as much time in Europe as she has, I mean, she knows what a good park looks like. She learned how to jump on a trampoline in Nice. She, you know, she's made friends at, you know, other little parks along the way. And so like, that's her thing now. But I know that as she gets older, she's going to start saying, okay, well, I want to go to this city or I want to do this experience. And I'm excited for it. I'm looking forward to it. I think that's a really cool aspect, because just the idea that you can sort of, I'd imagine that your daughter did a lot of planning for Venice, right? That you sat down and you said, okay, we'll go here sort of thing as well.
We talk about it, but you know, the interesting thing too is like, so like 2 years ago, we did a week of her winter break. She had like a 3 week break for some reason instead of two. And so we parked ourselves in Amsterdam for a week because like there's an Austin Amsterdam nonstop. I was able, you know, in January, I was able to get, you know, all the business class award seats I wanted at the saver level. You know, it was going to Amsterdam in January. But what did we do there? It was, you know, playgrounds, it was brunch. Right. It was like our meal, you know, it's like it's a very different travel. I love it because it's seeing it through her eyes and I want her to experience these things. I mean, but it also changes my hotel choices. So I would prefer to be more boutique and a local character maybe. But boy, I lean into Hyatt for suites, like confirmed suites. You know, it doesn't work for me to show up at the desk and like hope I'm getting upgraded. Like I value the extra space in the room that Hyatt. And then, you know, obviously there are also some kinds of travel where short-term rentals make sense with families. But in terms of hotel, I lean more into Hyatt than I used to. Although what that then causes me to do is lean less into it for my my own like business travel. It's like when I can stay where I want, like you know, because I've got to do all these, you know, longer family trips with them.
Any other strategies? I know hotels in Europe, for the time being, I just sort of don't tell them, which I've been able to get away with, but I don't think that's going to last for very much longer.
Yeah, you know, this is the annoying thing is in Europe, it's very common to have maximum occupancy limits in rooms, at least with many suites, it's maybe three, but often it's not four. And then you're looking at like two rooms and adjoining rooms, and most chains don't do adjoining very well. And so it becomes very complicated. And so I do, you know, work in advance with hotels on that where I can, if hotels are going to make sense. I mean, I think the biggest challenge is just the traveling with kids and trying to give them an experience that's going to work for them to make it easier for them on like the flights. So, always having activities that can change up with their attention span, with, night flights. I mean, obviously it's easy to say, well, what a hack is it to take them in business class, right? That's what it is. Because look, we do a bedtime routine that is just like at home, and we'll, read books at bed, change into pajamas, read books, have a story, now go to sleep. And so it's now just do the things you're used to and lay down as much as normal as possible, and try to maintain some semblance of schedule, which is obviously easier when my daughter became like 3.5 and older, than it is right now with my 1.5-year-old. And so look, it's really easy. Like 3 to 10 months is a super easy time because The plane is a giant white noise machine. Like they just go to sleep. Dallas, Sydney, no problem. Easy. Like we could do that. the Qantas A380 first class seat has it's not like a protruding bassinet. It's like a built-in cubby in the seat. Like you just stick the baby into the cubby. And there's like a, built-in seatbelt in there. You strap them in and they go to sleep from the white noise and, 12 hours and that's most of the flight. But then it's that mobile stage that's really hard.
Yeah, I feel like it's also a little bit of 3D chess. And as we're planning our trip to Australia, my wife and I were already talking about, okay, we've got to figure out what time that nap needs to be because this is a later flight. We made a mistake when we were flying. We flew Boston to Madrid on JetBlue over the summer, and we let her sleep, but she woke up about 20 minutes too early, almost on the dot. And so we had a little bit of that meltdown just as we're taxiing for takeoff. And with that JetBlue Mint seat, you've got like the where your feet are kind of out to the aisle. Here I am. I'm like kind of reaching over the seat to try to hold her hand. And she's not happy. I'm not, I'm not comfortable. And, all it took was us to get to 10,000 feet. And then she was fine. But it was that one kind of 10-15 minute period. And if we had just gotten that nap right, another 20-30 minute nap, and boom, she would have been out cold right at the right time and gotten a nice sleep. So it's
and you can't beat yourself up over it because you're not in a controlled environment of home. And it's I think what it really a lot of it comes down to is, you do the advanced planning. You think about how they're going to experience it. You have all the tools and all the if-then sort of statements. This happens in this, and you kind of plan it in advance. And you do those things. And frankly, you do some of them performatively. You can be seen doing them, and people around you give you a lot more credit than if the people who just kind of like throw up their hands. If you're visibly like doing everything, then I think most passengers aren't giving you the same hard time. But, there's only so much that you're ever going to be able to do. I think you just want to think about it through the lens of their experience and what it can possibly be and how they're processing. I had one real meltdown from my daughter, and she was just 3 years old, and we were coming back from Hawaii during the pandemic. And, I was trying not to laugh. Okay, because she was done. We're 20 minutes out from Austin, and she's just done. And her version of the meltdown was, "Daddy," she says, "I'm gonna take my mask off, and the police are gonna come get you."
Oh wow!
And it was just her way. If she's so serious, she's so frustrated, and we're just like, we're almost there. So, we, you do what you can and you give them the experiences that you can. You try not to look with Hawaii. We would do things like stop on the West Coast. So Austin, LA, spend the night. Right. This past spring with my son, you know, he was 9 months old. And we were going 10 months old, going to Paris. So let's fly to Toronto. How close can I get, right, to really shorten that transatlantic flight? Because we can do Austin, Toronto easy, spend the night in Toronto, take the Air Canada flight. It worked great. So, you know, you do what you can do, make it as good an experience as you can, and don't try to do experiences that you know you don't have a path to make them positive. Until they're older, you'll have chances.
That's the thing. I think Tom and I talk a lot about this on the podcast is we have a history of trying to force trips and force things and we're getting better at that. I think in some cases we are starting to call ourselves on you know, not forcing
things. I think we recognize when we're trying to, you know, really push that, you know, square peg into the round hole, you know?
Yeah. So being that the podcast's called Travel Stories, do you have a particular travel story that's fun that you've had, you know, perhaps with the family or perhaps, you know, before family that you'd share?
Yeah. I mean, look, there are so many, I mean, I've been so fortunate to have so many great experiences over the years. And I guess when you mentioned going to Europe for dinner, it represented something for me. Now, it was at the time we were having dinner at El Bulli, that at the time was the toughest reservation in the world to get. You used to get something like 10,000 requests per table. You used to take reservations one day a year, right? And it was all by email. And you knew that if it took them 2 months to get back to you, there was a good chance that it was a yes. Like the no's all came much more quickly. And so I had like responded to the previous year's rejection and somehow gotten a Saturday night. And so we had this dinner. But what I realized on some of these really early trips, and the reason I was happy to do we were in Roses, couple hours outside of Barcelona for just that night, was that I could always go back. And I never felt like the need to do everything in a single trip. Early on, so my wife and I have been married, you know, for 3 years. I was never a big fan of Western European capitals. Okay. Like I was always trying to get, you know, go to, you know, more far afield places. And she's like, I just want to go to Paris. You know, so one year there was I booked a mistake fare over Thanksgiving, mistake rate at, it's the Hilton, Marea, right? When it had changed over from Starwood to Hilton, they published their room rates in the wrong currency. So instead of CFP for, you know, French Pacific francs, they had published them in CDF or Congolese francs. And so it was everything was 90% off. So you booked the Overwater Villa inclusive with all meals. It was like $90 or something. You know, I booked that. And we had been to French Polynesia, you know, a couple of years earlier on our honeymoon. You know, so it wasn't like we'd never been, but I was like, it's right. But then the Prince de Galles, the Champs-Élysées in Paris, published a 52 euro a night mistake rate. And so I like booked that and took, and now I have to decide, do I want this like nice, you know, 52 euro a night stay off the Champs-Élysées or, you know, the French Polynesia? And she's like, well, I can never get you to go to Paris, right? If it's not on a mistake rate. So we've got to go do that. Okay. I've canceled my, I'd only made one booking for this Marea rate and they were honoring it. I got to cancel this one. Okay, cancel it. And she's like running me around Paris and we're doing all the things. And, you know, it was like, nope, we can go back. I mean, we go most years, you know, for a short trip because she does love it there. But anywhere that we've gone, it's like, okay, don't try to squeeze everything in because miles and points have made the world so much smaller. They've made it so much more accessible to me than I ever thought it would be, you know, growing up. I can go more places. The world is smaller. You know, it's not, you know, I can be someone who does this. It's so the trip isn't once in a lifetime. And that then allows me to, you know, travel more slowly, enjoy the things that I'm seeing, not ever make it a forced march, right? And I think get more out of it. Again, because I've been so fortunate to be involved in, you know, the hobby of miles and points, it's changed the way I see the world. It's changed the way that I connect to people in it. Meeting people and kind of understanding what their life is like, how it's the same as mine, how it's different than mine, you know, what kind of space people live. It helps me put events that I see in the world in a better context than if I've just read it. Not that I consider myself any, you know, expert on world affairs, but things make more sense to me having seen and interacted with and understand and talking to people. And so I'd say the biggest thing is, whether it's going for one day or going for a longer time, but not trying to cram everything into every day, the optionality of being able to go back, of being able to, you know, travel, you know, as much as my schedule allows and family schedules allow, just shrinks the footprint of the world and broadens my understanding. And that's probably, you know, what I'm most grateful for in it. It's not just about the game of, you know, earning and the game of redemption and getting the most value. It's the value that I can pick up along the way and hopefully how it changes my perspective.
That's so well said.
Can't agree more. You know, I think the idea of, you know, really looking at travel as something that you don't have to cram it all in at once, I think is definitely a way that, you know, I think I travel that way a lot of the time. You know, I'll catch that the next time, you know, like I think it took my third trip to Paris to go up the Eiffel Tower. So, you know, I made it there eventually.
Yeah. And we're the same way. I mean, even before our daughter, we sort of started to just, like, we had started out with this, okay, we're going to go to Paris for a long weekend. We're going to hit Versailles. We're going to do it all. And then there was some point where we just sort of said, okay, we're going to sit and have a nice, you know, glass of wine at the cafe, and we're just going to enjoy the, you know, mm-hmm. where we're at, rather than running from thing to thing to thing. And so now we just sort of we'll highlight a couple of points that we want to do on a trip. You know, we want to go to the zoo. We'd like to sit, you know, at a park, and then we just let the trip happen. And sometimes you just have different things. You happen upon an event that, you know, you just run into a flash mob or something interesting like that, and you just sort of let the trip happen for you.
Yep. It's fun getting a vibe of the place, and you're only going to get a vibe of the place if you really sit down and slow down a little bit and really absorb the environment, right?
Yeah, I'll share. So we did a cruise a couple of years ago out of Ravenna, Italy, and we did a night in Venice just because that was where I was able to get us a night at that Hyatt Centric Marina. And we walk around the corner, and we weren't really doing anything intentionally. We were just, we went over the main because my daughter hadn't been there. So we went to St. Mark's Square. We get back to the island, Murano Island, and we wander around and we find this nice little cafe, charcuterie board, some Prosecco, and we're just enjoying the afternoon. And we see first one family and then another family. And suddenly there's like three or four families. The kids are playing in a little courtyard and people are chatting, and everything just felt like, you know, that little view into life in on that island. And it's memories like that that I feel like just sort of, you can't force that. You can't manufacture that. You just have to be open to it.
And they're not always even good memories in a way. But they sometimes are ingrained in my brain that help me understand a place and beyond. So first time that I was in Mumbai, I had a really hard time, really struggling with the slums, right? And seeing even just the people who lived off the property of the hotel I was staying at, right? And these shanties, makeshift shanties, that people are living in. I was really, here I am in this like nice place, and I'm like visiting, and I'm totally comfortable, and all these people really aren't. And sitting there and looking at, but actually seeing some of the makeshift housing and people who worked in the hotel, like living in these little places, like off the hotel. Okay, they're actually making, so I'm looking at, what are they making? They're making a decent like money for the area, and they're choosing, not to spend it on accommodations. Many of them were sending it home to family and sort of like remittances and helping their family members. And they're living in these places that are kind of informal housing. They had satellite dishes, and they had plenty of communications, but there couldn't be much investment in the structure, and there were all these local laws and rules that were preventing it. I started like looking into, I remember sitting in my hotel room, like first just, white as a ghost, just sitting still, thinking about what I was seeing and experiencing. And it was very sad. And then sitting and reading about the, the rules and kind of the why for some of these housing and how the situation is being like, that you can't build up and build more density there, and you can't, that there weren't secure like property rights, and so you don't invest in building anything in these areas, and so people are choosing to live there in their own kind of makeshift communities to save money, and they don't want to have the long commutes, and they're sending money back, and it all starts, the picture starts to form and make sense, and I understand the problem in a way I never would have stopped to if I hadn't been there and been deeply affected by it. But boy, there was like a day I just couldn't go out. But it wasn't an abstraction anymore. It wasn't something you see in a movie. It was real people that I was interacting with in the hotel, and then I'm like seeing, like right there, I'm not sure how to put that into words, other than to say there are these incredibly special, nice moments where you just stop and experience a place, and then other moments where they might even be a little darker, but that you are still enriched by having a greater understanding of more of the human experience and of the world that you're interacting with than you ever would had you not have gone there. There's a richness that isn't always that can still be a downer. I would trade that situation for those people, but I wouldn't trade my having traveled to understand it for anything.
Yeah, it definitely, you understand a whole lot more than just reading it in a book, seeing it on a movie. I almost feel like when I do see movies of places that I've been, you sort of feel it. You feel the European streets, that sort of thing. I too have been to Mumbai, but I think we were there just not long enough. And thank you so much for sharing that. Really, I mean, that's the non, I hate to say it, that's like the B-side that we don't share, right? We all share the bougie suites and the bougie seats and the bubbles of the bottles of wine or that great find that you found at the Dubai first class lounge. We don't share the other side of it, right? We don't share that poor travel experience that you might have had, or just how emotionally impactful it is seeing how people live when you're enjoying that five star hotel.
And it reminds me of going to Hong Kong for the first time, and I don't think I've ever been to a place as dense, or at least the experience that I had up till that point in my life. I'm walking around some of the streets there and just, being in a mall, just having the amount of humanity in front of me, and that's not something that's going to make, a travel blog about, hey, this was my trip experience. But, it informs you that, hey, this place is really dense. There's a lot of people right on top of each other. And that's how people live, and that really informs. So I think I get where you're going with that, because you wouldn't understand that until you've seen it, until you've seen the amount of people in the space that you're in, and you're saying, wow, I've never been in my, I've never gone to the mall and had like so many people just on top of each other. And it's interesting. You know, that's what came to my mind. Just, you know, like you would never get that part of the environment until you were there, boots on the ground and experiencing yourself, for real life, because where, you know, how else are you going to understand it?
Well, but isn't it by design, right? I mean, yeah. You know, if you want tourism, you're not going to highlight the shanty towns or, you know, the lack of personal space. You're going to highlight the goodness, the 5-star hotels, the beautiful landmarks, that sort of thing. I think,
you know, some of that stuff informs, you know, the place would not be the place that it is without that, right? That's what enables all this verticality in the city and all the other dynamism and all the other things, because there are so many people that are right next to each other that they can do certain things that you can't do in every city, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we gotta try to end this on a more positive
note.
Yeah,
this has been a great discussion. It's so great having you, Gary. Thanks. You know, just to, you know, hear all these wonderful things, because, you know, this kind of discussion is really kind of just extremely exciting and interesting to me, because, you know, it's so central to kind of a lot of the things that we care about, right? You know, whether it be traveling or loyalty or strategies or, you know, all these type of things, we spend a lot of time on it. So it's just great having this type of discussion.
It really is. It really truly is. And it's been a wide ranging conversation, and we really appreciate it. Let's close out. You've shared a lot privately with us, about a number of different deals. You know, we've talked about the fuel surcharges out of Brazil that temporarily weren't accounted for by airlines. There was the track it backs. Is there one particular deal that you have leveraged over the last, you know, however many years that was your you know, miracle deal or your favorite deal?
You know, what's on the top of the heap?
Well, look, so, you know, there were many, many years. So 23 years ago, Randy Peterson was giving out points for subscribing to Inside Flyer, and mm-hmm. you could subscribe to have as many subscriptions as you wanted. And you had Starwood points, which back then used to transfer 1 to 2 into Qantas. And so you got the double bonus also. And, you know, 120,000 Qantas points was enough for the Concorde. And BA. And so there was like that. It's, you know, hard to be. So, you know, there's gold points and value mags back then, and, you know, Amy Cheese and all these like great, great historical deals. And obviously, you know, Trevor, you mentioned Track It Back, but which is fun in its own way because of all some of the backstory on that one. But I think in the last 4 years, nothing has beaten the American Airlines Simply Miles deal with, you know, MasterCard. They were doing sextuple miles for the holidays, and, you know, MasterCard was doing 40 miles per dollar for contributions to Conservation International. And they didn't quite know what they were getting into. It was actually a sextuple bonus on top of the 40. And so you're buying miles at like, you know, 45 basis points apiece, which was a great deal in and of itself, because it's the worst case you're redeeming for, you know, for a penny a piece, and you're still more than doubling your money. It's like whatever you put into it, like, how are you going to get hurt on this? It's great. And it was just so straightforward. It wasn't even like Track It Back, where you got to do 5, but, you know, more than 5 and not, you know, more than 10 transactions to the US Airways shopping portal, and you keep your costs low, and, you know, to get that bonus. But this was just straight up buying all these miles. And I never even expected or thought, because it was before, you know, loyalty points were going to start, that this was going to also have a status component. And so the amazing thing about it, and I did 7 million miles through that. I had readers who did like twice as many as I did. I did 7 million AAdvantage miles, which is great in itself. But then they looked at the revenue attached to my account and maybe concierge key. Right. And so the deal, you know, got me that experience too, which is a total surprise. One day, basically everybody that did 5 million or more miles on that deal got concierge key. So that was not anything that any of us expected when we were doing the deal. And I guess that's what makes it my personal favorite.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember that. I don't think I was targeted for that personally, but I remember a lot of people were really excited about that. And that's one of those unicorns that I hope we see again. but I doubt it.
But, you know, all these things, I never thought I'd see any of these like it again before that one came. So
that's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. So opportunities come around.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for giving us your time. It's always a privilege to chat with you, period. And to be able to record it and share it with our listeners is just absolutely awesome. What we usually like to do is give you a chance to share how folks can find you, whether it's, you know, the blog or through the socials.
Yeah, so you can find me at viewfromthewing.com and across social media platforms at Gary Leff.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Gary, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Always good to talk to you both and to see you both.
Likewise. Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you enjoyed listening.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member and get access to even more in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.